Well, can I first of all welcome you. My name is Michael Bishard and I'm Rector of the University of the Arts London. I'm very pleased to welcome you to this, the first public forum organised by POLIS, which, as you probably know, is a joint venture between the LSE and the University of the Arts London. More about that later for those of you who can come to the reception. But suffice to say at this point, I think the success of POLIS will depend upon our ability to attract speakers who will reflect, challenge, stimulate, and provoke, speakers who have the courage to ask difficult questions, but informed by having worked with the media or been exposed to the workings of the media. So I can't think of anyone better to start that process than the Home Secretary, Charles Clark. We first met, Charles, when you came to the Department of Education and Employment as a minister and I was permanent secretary. You said very quickly, "I think you should know that my father was once a permanent secretary." And I said, "I think rather defensively, I think you should know that I'm not a traditional permanent secretary." You said, "I'd heard." I quickly discovered that Charles was not a traditional minister either, so we actually got along rather well. He perhaps shares a tendency on rare occasions to be a touch robust. Some might even say direct. I have a feeling that might be reflected in what he has to say tonight. The Home Secretary, Charles Clark.
Michael, thank you for that introduction, and thank you very much for inviting me this evening. I want to begin by congratulating the University of the Arts and the London School of Economics for forming POLIS, this organisation to promote discussion and understanding of the media. I think it's very important that we do this. I think it's a very important quality of our universities to investigate and address these matters, and I congratulate you on doing this, and I wish you the best of luck in carrying it through. I've been asked this evening to talk about the relationship between the media and politics. Of course, there's a great deal to be said about this subject, and indeed much has already been said and written by very many people indeed. But I want to focus today on what I think is at the core of the problem, which is the differing and conflicting agendas from which politics and the media discuss the world and address it. Part of this is about the recurrent theme of agenda setting, or as it's called in the vernacular, spin. I've argued before, and will not repeat in detail today, however, my view that it's the media whose direct access to the majority of the public, which no politician can even contest, who have been for some decades now the principal spinners of truth as they've sought to be the public agenda setters. It's their grip which politicians of all colours have sought to contest, and I believe that this is even truer in the 7/24 media world where synthetic novelty and personality take on great importance to media planners. Such disputes about political, policy or public agendas are now par for the course, and the various media outlets, whether TV and radio, news and current affairs programmes, or great national newspapers, all have their own approach to political debate, to which politics and politicians have to adapt as best they can. However, more profound, and of an entirely different order, is the prism through which the media sees its role in relation to the wider world. And this means, and for the purpose of the discussion that I wish to address this evening, how it conducts the debate over civil liberties. I think that the debate stems from the entirely noble view of the free media as a fundamental bastion against dictatorship and totalitarianism. There are many examples of the importance of that role. I have no doubt, for example, that one of the main reasons for the relatively peaceful collapse of the apartheid state or of totalitarianism in the former Soviet Empire is the influence of the free media upon the peoples of those countries. And of course, the advance of democracy has been profound and substantial, and I think it's important to set it out very clearly. As recently as the early 1970s, when I was at university, there was fascism in Spain and Portugal and a military regime in Greece. Totalitarian communism dominated Eastern and Central Europe. Apartheid South Africa was accompanied by colonialist regimes throughout Southern Africa. Latin and Central America were dominated by military dictatorship. And in Asia, democratic India was very much the exception. But now in all these parts of the world, democracy has been established. Of course, still evolving, of course, still facing very real difficulties, of course still needing very material improvement, but also very much better, in my opinion, than the totalitarianism or military despotism which it replaces. And my generation has been brought up upon those struggles for democracy. Many of us participated in small ways, and all of us, both in politics and the media, were deeply influenced by the experience. And of course, the campaign for democracy continues, both in seeking to deepen it in the parts of the world which I've described, but also notably in the Middle East, where some of the issues around extending democracy are very complex and difficult indeed. So in this campaign for democracy in replacing dictatorship and totalitarianism, I believe the media has, with a great deal of justification, been able fairly to see itself as on the side of the good guys of progress in relation to those changes which take place. But I believe that a pernicious and even dangerous poison is now slipping into at least some parts of this media view of the world. In the absence of many of the genuinely dangerous and evil totalitarian dictatorships to fight, since they've gone, the media has steadily rhetorically transferred to some of the existing democracies, particularly the United States and the United Kingdom, some of the characteristics of those dictatorships. So some commentators routinely use language like police state, fascist, hijacking our democracy, creeping authoritarianism, destruction of the rule of law, while words like Holocaust, Gulag, and apartheid are regularly used descriptively of our society in ways which must be truly offensive to those who experienced those realities. And as these descriptions and language are used, the truth just flies out of the window, as does any adherence to professional journalistic standards or any requirement to examine the facts and to check them with rigour. In the case of often complex debates, for example, on the appropriate balance between liberty and security, much media comment reduces itself to simplistic, sometimes flowery, rhetoric. One recent example of this was the articles of Henry Porter, which simulated the email exchange between him and Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, in yesterday's Observer. Another example is Simon Carr's article in The Independent on April the 15th, which lists 34, in his words, measures and effects, which in his opinion mean that in this country we no longer live in a liberal and democratic society. Many of those assertions are frequently accepted as fact by media commentators. I have replied to him, to Simon Carr, pointing to his numerous and unprofessional misleading statements, as well as to the many errors of fact. A copy of my reply in detail is on the Home Office website if anybody wants to look at it. But let me draw your attention to a number of these frequently asserted myths where incorrect, tendentious, and oversimplified statements have been made about this government's record on civil liberties. Carr asserts, for instance, that, in his words, damaging GM crops is defined as a terrorist act, unquote. Where is this idea from? Nowhere in terrorism legislation is damaging GM crop fields defined as a terrorist act. Damaging crops is a criminal act on its own account and would be treated as such by the police where appropriate. Well, what about the statement, again from Mr. Carr, I quote, people wearing satirical T-shirts in a designated area may be arrested under the Prevention of Terrorism Act. The City of London is a permanently designated area. Wrong again. There is no such provision in any Prevention of Terrorism Act, nor is there any law against bad taste in T-shirts, as long as they don't, for example, incite murder. And I particularly like this one, and again I quote him, the National Identity Register may be used to record every sort of personal information, such as withdrawing more than £200 from the bank, getting prescription drugs, voting, applying for a mortgage, taking out an insurance policy, even applying for a fishing licence. Again, wholly untrue, I'm glad to report. The National Identity Scheme is being introduced to safeguard people's identities, not to track their lifestyle or activities. The information that can be held on the National Identity Register covers only basic personal information, roughly the same as that needed for a passport. It will not include details of withdrawals of cash from bank accounts, medical records, or even whether someone has obtained a fishing licence. In other instances set out by Mr. Carr, some assertions are broadly right. For example, on whether, again his quotations, people can protest in Parliament Square only with the written permission of the police, where reasonably practical 6 days' notice must be given, unquote. But what is not added is that in some cases 24 hours is sufficient, or that since the legislation came into effect last August, 157 demonstrations have taken place in Parliament Square, ranging from human rights in Burma to a protest about the right to protest itself, and incidentally regularly criticising the Prime Minister for various respects. Organisers of demonstrations, it's true that all of those 157 demonstrations must give prior notice to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, who is then obliged to authorise the demonstration, although he may attach conditions to the authorisation where necessary. This, by the way, is more or less the same as the situation that prevailed in the 1970s, when I myself organised demonstrations in Parliament Square, at which students from this university attended. It's also right, as Simon Carr has set out, that, I quote him, 3 million DNA samples are held on file, rising to 4 million in 2 years. And thank goodness for that, I say. In 2004-05, the detection rate rose from 26 to 40% in cases where DNA was successfully recovered from a crime scene. The DNA databases now holds the majority of the known active offender population and is a powerful tool for solving crime, both historic and present, and rightly so. And let me conclude in addressing Mr. Carr's piece by one of the more ridiculous statements that he made, and I quote, "The presumption of innocence is no longer a fixed legal principle," unquote. This is complete nonsense. In this country, you are innocent of an offence until proven guilty, and quite rightly so. But let us not confuse, as some people have tried to do with this assertion, the presumption of innocence with the need, in my opinion, the urgent need, to prevent criminal acts ranging from antisocial behaviour at the lower level to, at the extreme level, terrorism. Ordinary people also have the right to be protected. I've mentioned Henry Porter and Simon Carr and their assertions. Yet another example is Jenny Russell writing in The Guardian on April the 6th, who writes, and I quote her, that Tony Blair's administration is removing the safeguards that protect all of us from the whims of a government and the intrusion of a powerful state. It's engaged, she says, in a ferocious power grab. These are ridiculous assertions, utterly unsupported in a lengthy article by any hint of understanding the balance of powers which currently exist in our society, whether the balance legally or the balance politically. It's at one with her assertion in today's Guardian that, again I quote, Britain is about to create a tracking system for its citizens, unprecedented in the Western world, which would allow officials, foreign governments and hackers to follow almost everything we do, unquote. A fantasy just about as dark as it's possible to imagine, and again, completely untrue. These pieces are, in my opinion, symptomatic of a more general intellectual laziness, which seeks to slip onto the shoulders of modern democratic states the mantle of dictatorial power. Some of this, it's true, follows from criticism of the United States, and particularly the policy of the Bush administration, notably in relation to Iraq, but more generally in criticism of the response of the US and the UK to the 9/11 attack. I believe that such criticism fails to understand the immense significance of 9/11 in clarifying the nature of the new world that is emerging so strongly in this century. From 1945 until the end of the 20th century, it was the fight for democracy against dictatorship which dominated both the media and politics. Nazism and Stalinism were the twin enemies, and only after 1990 could totalitarian communism be said to be in retreat. In that climate, it was the human rights of the individual in relation to the state which were preeminent. Those politicians and journalists who fought for individual rights against the tyrannical state set the agenda. It was in response to those imperatives that various United Nations conventions and the European Convention on Human Rights were established and became central to our experience. However, as democracy has advanced so powerfully across the world in the way I described at the beginning of the remarks I made here, other rights become important too, and let me cite some. The right to go to work safely on the tube, the right not to be killed by someone who served his sentence for violent crime but remains dangerous, the right to live at home without being disturbed by antisocial behaviour outside the front door, and much more. None of these rights remove the right of any individual to exercise their freedoms in relation to the state. None of these rights remove the obligation on the state to operate in accordance with its national and international obligations under law. But all of these other rights, the ones I've cited and many more, are also real rights which have meaning for people. All of them are the routine subject of complaint, in my opinion justified, to which democratic politicians have rightly the obligation to respond. But when we do respond to these other rights being violated in the way I've described, for example with counter-terror legislation, for example with proposals to try and control those criminals who are dangerous to society, for example with antisocial behaviour orders, many in the media retort that we're destroying democracy and constructing tyranny. And too many, in my opinion, resort to misrepresentation and deceit to try and strengthen their case. So my appeal this evening is to urge our media to come to terms with a modern concept of rights and responsibilities in our society, to continue their historically important campaign to replace dictatorship with democracy, whilst recognising that an enormous amount has been achieved in recent decades, to accept and applaud the differences between democratic states and dictatorships, to accept the modern reality that human rights are wider than simply those rights which the individual possesses in relation to the state, and to work together with politics to consider how best these rights too can be fulfilled. It's a very enormous challenge, but I believe that many in politics, many in the media want to engage in that, and I hope, Michael, that Polis will be able to help and develop the discussion as to how that might be achieved in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. We now have time for some questions. If you could just indicate where you come from, that might be helpful to us. Who you are?
Name is Kavi. I speak as a citizen. You have mentioned in your rebuttal of Simon Carr's article your belief that the presumption of innocence is well and alive. And I would just give you two instances and ask you to respond how you equate that with the actual facts of life in today's Britain. Lindis Percy last year was hauled up under the antisocial behavior orders in front of a court. Of course, you will say that the legislation does not specify a person, a grandmother like Lindis Percy, to be hauled up under those those offenses. I also remind you about July the 22nd, an innocent citizen shot at Stockwell without being charged, without being given a chance to justify what was the charges against him. I myself am a person who, by your control order regimes, was forced to justify his conduct. And the instance was these 9 deportees that you have been trying to deport. I'm the one who provided bail address to one of them, and for that duty as citizen, as a British citizen, which I felt obliged to give a hand to an underdog, I was asked to disconnect my telephone line, to remove my computer, not to allow any person, even my own children and my wife, to visit my home. How do you reconcile all these with what you have just said? Thank you.
Well, do you want to do one at a time? Very, very, very straightforwardly. Let me take each of the three cases separately because they're quite different in character. Firstly, the antisocial behaviour order and the operation of the antisocial behaviour order regime, which you mentioned. Well, you've illustrated precisely my point in the way that you intervened at that point. The antisocial behaviour order has one request. It is that people should not behave antisocially. it says to the person who's in receipt of an antisocial behaviour order, which has to be passed by a court, dealt with by a court, please do not do something which is antisocial. It doesn't condemn anybody to prison or to any other aspect of what happens. It simply says that you should not engage in antisocial behaviour order. It is true that if you then do engage in antisocial behaviour, as specified by the order, then you are liable in breach of the order to sanctions, including prison. But the key fact is that it is, in my opinion, entirely reasonable to say to somebody you should not behave in a specified antisocial way in a situation that arises, and that a court should deal with it in that way. Why? For the fact is that there are many, many communities up and down this country which are deeply and negatively affected by antisocial behaviour in that community. And to ask people to behave in a broadly social manner which respects others, I think is entirely reasonable. There are no
specific case.
I'm not going to comment on specific cases at all, and the Home Secretary does not, and rightly so, comment on specific cases. Judgments that have been made by courts are the judgments made by the courts. As far as July the 22nd is concerned, the killing of Mr. De Menonis was an absolutely shocking and terrible event. There is absolutely no question of that whatsoever. The whole circumstances around that are being investigated by the Independent Police Complaints Commission, and they will publish their report in due case. And they are going through precisely what was done right, what was done wrong in that proposal. If they were to conclude, I don't expect them to do this, but were they to conclude that there'd been some decision in some sense to shoot an individual because of some act that they had committed, which was actually a crime and they were being punished, as it were, on a shoot-to-kill basis, that is something the IPCC would say and would be extremely serious, and we would address it in that context. But the fact is, and it's a fact where I have to say, and I obviously think you will disagree with me, I have sympathy for the police in those circumstances on the 22nd, when in fact there was a wide variety of circumstances where there were potential explosions, potential terrorist acts, potential suicide bombers, very soon after events where it's actually taken place and dozens of people had been killed. And of course, people may fear they never hear the truth. The Independent Police Complaints Commission will make their report, and people will judge it when they do on that basis. Now, on the control order regime, the reason why we have control orders is precisely to inhibit the possibility of terrorist action. And there is, in each case of a control order, a decision judged by a judge who has to make their view about the position as to whether a control order should or shouldn't be granted, and a whole hearing which deals with those particular aspects. Of course, there are issues about the nature of those hearings, as you're implying in what you say in your own case, and those are serious issues which need to be addressed, and in fact are being addressed all the time, and whether we get it in the right way. But I say again, and it's a very, very serious thing, if there are people, and there are people, whose intention it is to create terrorist acts in this country, in this city, and to kill people on that basis, I think, certainly I as Home Secretary, others may disagree, think we have an obligation to do everything in our power to prevent that happening. The preferred action is through prosecution and through law, and that's why we've set out changes in the law to make those prosecutions possible. But there remain cases where the control order regime is the only way, in our opinion, which we can deal with that threat and protect the safety of people in this city. So there are different cases that you've mentioned. In each case, I don't think it's right to say the presumption of innocence has been taken away.
I'm keen that as many people as possible should have a chance to ask or comment. So can we take two or three questions and make them reasonably brief? Yes, and then there. Microphone coming from.
Now, the Prime Minister, in explaining or trying to explain the reason for the one that the Home Secretary calls urgent, said he was mystified as to the exact reason for this urgent need, that it might be due to some peculiar condition of modern society. In fact, the Prime Minister generally says all the things he wants to do are made necessary by mysterious changes in modern society, which weren't present in the Cold War years. Now, I'd like to present a more straightforward explanation for the undoubtedly urgent need for something like the antisocial behaviour orders. This is something that the government hasn't addressed. It's the almost total collapse of an institution we used to have called civil legal aid. Now, a lot of my journalistic career was spent trying to help what the government calls ordinary people to take action against various injuries done to them. It was difficult to get civil legal aid 30 years ago. It is now practically impossible. And that's not out of wickedness, it's just because the government has not paid proper attention to the fact. A tremendous amount of the problems that people try to address by antisocial behaviour are caused by the fact that the poor cannot defend their territory, and indeed by a central flaw in the legal aid system as set up, which it was not designed to give the poor the rights of the rich. That's a direct quote. Now, why not, instead of a radical and misunderstood, wildly impractical system, which mainly targets children, 50% of antisocial behaviour orders are made against children, which was quite against the government's original proposition, but developed in ways nobody thought it would. Why not do what this government is reluctant to do, which is strengthen, look again at traditional virtues, the rule of law, and the civil way, very, very important. It is our right to protest against noisy neighbours. That used to be possible. For middle-class people, it's eminent.
Yes.
Nobody gives the middle class that trouble because they call their lawyers.
Now, thank you.
Why is this a problem?
I feel like I should declare an interest here. There's a question down here. Can we make it reasonably brief? Yeah.
Yes. The first point is a point of fact, Secretary, that we've been in the midst of the peaceful transition from apartheid. It's just that. It's a myth.
Current historiography would dictate that it was a myth and there's a lot of fighting involved. But my question relates to how ID cards exactly going to stop events, the terrible and tragic events such as 7/7. And I say this in the context that, for example, Bush has not introduced ID cards to stop terrorist acts, and I'm just wondering how exactly they would have counteracted events such as 7/7 and why you feel the need to justify them.
Okay.
I suppose, in your role as Home Secretary, there's been much institutional debate about the regulation of press. Where do you stand on that?
Paul Sharman is a lecturer at the University of the Arts, London.
Well, head journalist. Head,
indeed. I would just be modest on your behalf. Knowing that you wouldn't yourself.
If I can give you a tip, Michael, as a leader of an institution, always pay tribute to the titles and roles of those who work with you in various ways.
I remember how well you did it.
I've always done it as well as I could. Bruce, it's nice to see you. I think there's two points I really want to make. The first is, I think there's no doubt we are in a world of change and things are moving differently. Now, there are different changes in different ways. I agree things like antisocial behaviour are not qualitatively different to what happened years ago. But I think if you look at the 1950s, for example, you will find a completely different level of crime taking place in society as a whole. A stronger sense of collective action. Communities were stronger in different ways. And I think that has led to a less controlled, if that's the right word, regime on many estates and in many circumstances. So change does have, in my opinion, to be addressed. I'm interested in your idea on civil legal aid and how it would work. My doubt about it is not the principled one, because I think there could be a case for it, but I think the main problem is not the funding of the legal challenge, though that may be an issue. The main problem is how effectively the legal system actually operates in its timescales and how it works to address particular problems that arise with some kind of expedition and address. And I think that is a real issue in the whole process, as is the issue of how our decisions of the court to be carried through and effectively enforced. But I think it's an interesting point, the civil legal aid point, and I will think about that. In terms of peaceful, I certainly don't think the transition to democracy in South Africa was peaceful. The word I used was relatively peaceful, and I think that is true. I think in terms of and I twinned that with what I said was relatively peaceful, transition to democracy in totalitarian Eastern and Central Europe. I think nobody in Eastern and Central Europe could have imagined that the changes would have taken place with such relatively little violence. Now, of course, violence exists in both places, more in South Africa, actually, probably, than in Eastern and Central Europe. But I do think, and it's the point I was trying to make in that passage of what I said, the role of the world media was an important element, in my opinion, a positive element, in trying to help those transitions to be less violent than they otherwise might have been. On ID cards, I don't believe that ID cards, or indeed any other measure, would be a silver bullet which would solve the issue of terrorism. I don't think if we had ID cards you could say 7/7 wouldn't have happened, for the sake of argument. What I do think you can say is that identity fraud is a central modus operandi for many terrorists, for many serious and organised criminals, and you can see that frequently in the way that they operate, and that they, lesser ability to operate in that way would make it more difficult for terrorist organisations to function. There is a particular example from Madrid of ID cards being necessary to buy certain types of mobile phone, which enabled people to be identified on the Madrid bombing. Otherwise, that wouldn't have applied here because we haven't got the same kind of rules and regulations. So I think ID cards would help deal with terrorism, but I certainly don't believe they would be the solution that would suddenly mean it went away. It's a far more deep-rooted matter than that. On the regulation of the media, that's a fascinating subject. I'm in danger of moving down a course by giving you my personal view. I'll give you my personal view, but I emphasise at great length and as assiduously as I can that it is my personal view and not the position of the government. My own view is that the code of conduct operated through the Press Complaints Commission ought to be put on a statutory basis. But that is not the position of the government, it's my own view. I think we ought to move towards a regulated regime for the media, where the media regulates it, not the state, but where the media regulates it, but their decisions are actually enforced. There are far too many breaches of the code of conduct, which, in my opinion, are not properly carried through and don't properly operate, and so I'd go for a stronger regime. That's bitterly hated by many parts of the media, but it is actually my own personal view. But I'm sorry to re-emphasise this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to imply, because it's not the case, that's the view of the government. It's the view of the government.
I'm sure tonight you'll be view. Fairly reported.
Yes.
I'm going to try and take three more questions.
Sorry, I don't want to abuse the power of this microphone. Shall we take one from the terrace here?
Yeah, there was one up.
Okay.
I was going to come to you after the lady
ahead of you. I thought I haven't seen that.
So just be patient. Lady here. The lady at the back and you. Well, the lady there, I think, had a... Oh. Well, I was looking at you, yes. You had your hand up some time ago.
Thanks. Jayanthi Durai. I've got concerns about the media and regarding its kind of the negativity of the media and its impact on our long-term well-being. However, in this case, with regards to the issue of civil liberties in the media, aren't the views reflecting, you know, along the lines of kind of creeping authoritarianism, haven't they been backed by members of the judiciary, academic experts, civil society groups, and isn't it only fair that the media reflects those range of views?
Thank you. Yes.
My name is Hossam Sukari. I'm from the BBC World Service, from the Arabic Service. And it's just a question that relates fundamentally to the title of this lecture, because my understanding is that we are talking about news. If we say the news we deserve and the examples that we have gone through are not actually news, they are views. And I do believe that the government and the Home Secretary has got a very good chance of exposing and going through the view of the government. And that has been throughout the coverage in the press, in TV, in radios. And I don't think that there is any doubt that you have got a fair chance of talking about the measures that you would like to implement. And if it's the views that we deserve, isn't it democracy that there are sometimes views that you will feel uncomfortable with, and in return you will find lots of other supporters of the views that you have been trying to get through? Isn't it democracy?
Thank you. And the lady at the back, and then we'll take those three questions together.
Hi, I'm a student here at LSE. My question is about the identity cards, and the Information Systems Department at the LSE has been analyzing this issue for a long time, and there have been many reports out. And since we're talking about the news, and that sometimes the news does not, you know, talk about the government, you know, partially or in a neutral way, the current government has used the news as well to attack a certain member in our department and has accused him of being a liar. How do you comment on that?
Did you say the Likud government?
Excuse me?
Did you say the Likud government?
No, in our department. A lecturer in our department.
Okay, fine. A lecturer in your department. Okay, sorry. slightly lost there.
It's an age problem.
One point, first of all. I have no difficulty, I'm not uncomfortable in any respect, with anybody in the media, or indeed a whole newspaper, or a whole regime, a whole television or radio programme, whatever, attacking a government policy, a government individual, a style approach. I think that is what a free media is all about, and I think that is absolutely fine, and I think it would be a very serious thing indeed if we weren't working on that basis. What I do say, and this is the point I was trying to make, perhaps I didn't convey it as effectively as I want to, is I think that it's very important that as that is done, it is done with rigorous attention to professional journalistic standards and tries to report what is actually being said and how it's being addressed, what is actually happening, rather than through inventing things as they move forward. Now, in the context of a range of different opinion, you're quite right, judiciary, academic, civil society have criticisms to make. Those should be expressed in the media. I absolutely would not wish to deal with that in any way other than that being expressed where it is expressed. But the media has a job, in my opinion, a difficult job, by the way, of ensuring that that debate between a particular academic opinion or judicial opinion, a government opinion or whatever, is done in a way which is properly respects the facts in that debate. That's all I argue. I argue for polemic. I think polemic is important. I think putting contrary positions strongly is important. I'm in favour of it. I think that is how democracy operates, and politics should too, by the way. But I don't think it's always the case, to simply put it like that. That's what I was trying to say in my remarks, that the media always does this in the most professional way, and that is what I think it should do. As far as Sam's point is concerned, it's the same point, really, in response to it. I think the objective, if you take the BBC World Service for which you work, the BBC World Service is generally regarded, I think rightly, as having a very high professional standard in the way that it reports news and the way which it addresses it. And I think that is generally the case for the BBC World Service. I don't make the same remark for all broadcasting media. I don't make the same remark for all journalistic media. But I think that the standard which is set should be of professionalism and working in that way, and that's what should happen. News itself ought to be, as objectively as can possibly be established, news, not views, and that should be what happens. I don't think that's always the case in the way that everything operates, either in terms of the actual news item itself or in terms of the selection of what is a news item and what is not a news item. And I know it's difficult, and I know there are professional issues which are at stake here, but my appeal, and that's what I said at almost the final remark of my speech, is for politics and media to work together to try and see how that can be done in the best possible way. On ID cards, I'm not sure how politic it would be to go and repeat the conversations that we had about the LSC so-called research on ID cards as it went through these proposals. I will say that the LSC demonstrated an ability to use the media in a very sophisticated way, which I found most impressive. And I don't think the LSC can claim that its views on this matter, which I don't accept, weren't widely reported, because they were.
Two final questions, one from the upper house. And I'm not sure how on earth to do this other than a ballot, but I'll have that lady in the front row. Middle of the front row. You've already got a microphone.
Hi, Mr. Clark. I speak as someone who was travelling to work on July the 7th in the first carriage at King's Cross, and end up severely injured as a result of what happened on the 7th of July. And I have two questions, really. The first is that you seem very reluctant to have a public inquiry, and you come out and said there's going to be a narrative explaining what happened. I think we all know what happened. I think I could write that narrative, and many other people in this room could write that narrative of what happened. What I'd like to understand is why that happened, and I'm not sure whether there's a reason why you won't do that, but I'd be interested to hear your explanation of why you will not look into what happened and why it happened and issue that publicly and let people speak on that. And the second thing I'd like to ask is why the victims of July the 7th or the people involved have been widely ignored by your government, and the people who were severely injured have had no contact whatsoever from the government other than a letter that arrived from Tessa Jowell 9 months on, which advised people that the best way to attend the meeting was to either go by tube or by bus. And that's actually a fact.
Rather hoping this is going to have something to do with the media.
Yeah, I was just wondering for what reasons you chose to spend your time as Home Secretary here tonight giving this lecture.
Okay, on the first question, it's a very difficult question, the question of public inquiry or not into these events. We've actually got a whole series of events, including inquiries. Just there is the narrative report, which I think actually will be interesting to people, both who are involved and who are not. There's the Intelligence and Security Committee inquiry into what happened in terms of what we knew about intelligence and security, which will be published in the coming weeks, as will the narrative. There is a London Assembly inquiry into what happens and how issues were dealt with thereafter, because there are major issues about how well we did and how well we didn't do in respect of particular issues which arose. I do think that there should have been more dialogue with the victims. There was dialogue at St Paul's and some other events. I'm actually having a meeting with some of the victims in the coming weeks to discuss some of the issues that I'm sure you would want to raise. I hope that we can find a way for the frustration which you express about what has happened in relation to you and colleagues of yours who were on the train to express itself in a more constructive way. Why did I come here tonight? Partly out of deep, enduring, undying love for Michael B. Shard and Howard Davis and desire to encourage their approach. I'm confident it will be treated in the spirit in which I meant it. The genuine reason is this. I saw Michael in a different context, and he mentioned as an aside that POLIS was being established. And I think there is wholly insufficient discussion about the role of the media in modern society. If you go back to the 1960s when I was young, and Marshall McLuhan's remarks, the medium is the message, and how that operates, if you look at the way the media has changed over those years, if you look at the role and significance of the media in relation to very many things, I don't mean just politics, but right across the whole range of the operation of life in this country in many, many, many different ways, I think it's important that the media are given more attention than they often are. And I wanted to, therefore, support this initiative of setting up POLIS in the way that it's happened. As far as I personally was concerned, quite apart from that generally, I believe there are important messages for the conduct of political life and public life in this country, which affect me day to day as Home Secretary. For example, I was talking today to about 1,000 probation officers in this country about big problematic issues. And one of the points I made to them is that the way the media addresses the kinds of issues which they have to deal with, often, not often, but from time to time, leading to terrible crime, including murders of people in certain circumstances who perhaps there were failures which led to that which shouldn't have happened. And finding a way that we develop our approach on offender management in the context of a 724 media world is a real issue. But that applies to a whole range of different things. I mentioned offender management because I happen to have been speaking to this probation event this morning. I think the role of the media in all this and how it operates is an important question for public debate. It's certainly an important question for the conduct of politics. I'm the survivor of the 1992 Labour election defeat, the somewhat won it. And I think there is also political questions about the direction and thrust of our society that we have to address. So I want to encourage debate about that. I don't expect to persuade everybody of my views on these things, but I think it's important that the debate takes place, and that's why I pay tribute at the beginning to the University of the Arts and Michael and LSE and Howard for encouraging this kind of way of going about things, because I think it's important for democracy generally.
Well, I don't think there are many more important issues than the relationship between politics and the media. I don't think there are many more complex, controversial and sensitive issues. That's why POLIS was set up. And I think some of the debate this evening has illustrated just how important it is that POLIS has been set up. It's why we invited you to come along, because we knew that you would address the issues with courage and in a direct way. And I'm very grateful for you having taken the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, there is a reception, which means there's free drink, and where it is will be known to those from the LSE, but I just, for the life of me, can't remember, but I'm sure people will show you as you leave. Thank you for coming along, and do come and have a drink.